This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone. This is Ken Barney. Welcome you once again to our program, This Week in Palestine. Each week we put on this 45-minute program offering you news and discussion about Palestine, about the struggle of the Palestinian people against the ongoing colonization and ethnic cleansing of their homeland. This is a situation that's been going on now for more than 63 years, and it just goes on and on and on. Our perspective here is, of course, not what you will find in the mainstream media. This program was created by the late Sharif Fahm. He produced this program for many years, and we continue to mourn the loss of our friend Sharif. But now we have a small group of us, friends and colleagues of his, and we're keeping this program going in Sharif's memory. This morning, rather than a live interview, we're again going to play a recording, a 30-minute talk given by Ali Abunima at a three-day Palestine solidarity conference held recently in Germany, in Stuttgart, Germany. I want to say a bit about this conference and the significance of its being held in Germany. Over 200 people were there in attendance, German activists and people from six other Western countries. The main speakers were Germans and Palestinians, plus also Ilan Pape, the great Israeli historian who now lives in England. And last Sunday, if you were listening, we played for you a recording of Ilan's talk. The Palestinian speakers included Haidar Aid from Al-Aqsa University in Gaza, Ali Abunima, who we will hear today. Ali is the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, and he lives in Chicago. Also speaking there was Palestinian activist Lubna Masarwa from Jerusalem, and she's one of the leaders of the Free Gaza movement. And finally, there was Mazen Kumsie. He lived here for many years, and he's now at Birzeit University in Ramallah. Many of you know earlier this week at a protest in the Bethlehem area, Mazen was part of a group that arrested by the Zionist military. Now, a few more words about Germany. I think it's indeed significant that this conference was held there. In all Western countries, there is this resistance to dealing with Palestine. We know this very well. But the situation in the United States and Germany is certainly worse than anywhere else. When we examine the Zionist narrative and its justification for the Zionist project, we see how they continually employ this exploitation of Holocaust memory. I mean, they employ it nonstop. A number of important books have been written about this, along with the critique of this whole notion of eternal victimhood. But this tactic certainly continues to play a major role in the success of the so-called narrative. In fact, we certainly can argue that it's the linchpin of Zionist ideology. It's at work constantly in all Western countries, but especially here in the United States and certainly in Germany. I might add that some analysts who write about this prefer the term instrumentalization, saying that, quote, the instrumentalization of Holocaust memory. Of course, if you talk about this at all, you're running the risk of being labeled anti-Semitic. Certainly the case here in the United States. But in Germany, it's much worse. It's quite risky to criticize Israel or Zionism. One of the more critical Israeli writers, who was certainly a friend of Palestine, he refers to this tactic as, quote, the Auschwitz bludgeon, end of quote. Well, certainly the unspeakable depravity of Nazism did indeed include the extermination of 6 million Jews, along with many millions of others who were also considered to be enemies of the Nazis. as they were trying to carry out their fantastic attempt to, carry out this inter-European colonization war, which certainly the most spectacular and horrific war in modern history. We certainly have an enormous amount of history and analysis about all this, about the world wars, about Nazism and the Holocaust. But all of this serious historical work is, for the most part, ignored in Western countries. And closely related to this, we find this abysmal ignorance about the whole subject of comparative genocide. Now, this is not the case with a later generation of serious genocide scholars. And their big perspective about all of this is extremely important. But, you know, when we look at the general population, I mean, the general population doesn't pay much attention to all this great writing and history. So, as a result, the Holocaust continues to occupy a sacred status. And again, it certainly serves mightily as a linchpin of Zionist ideology and propaganda. And of course, for the Zionists, all this general ignorance is terrific. It's just great. And it works very well with their manufacturing of hysteria about the so-called new anti-Semitism. Now, in Germany, this situation is even worse. In Germany, there's now 65 years of collective guilt still at work, acting as a powerful inhibition against any criticism of Israel or Zionism. In the German psyche, they're still embedded these ideas of pure Nazi evil and pure Jewish victimhood. But the good news is that we are finally seeing some cracks opening up over there, although this is happening slowly. And what has all this meant for the Palestinians? Well, Edward Said described the problem many years ago. Edward argued that the tragedy of the Jews in Europe also culminated in the Palestinian tragedy, the Nakba. And that, and I'm quoting Edward, the Jewish tragedy led directly to the Palestinian catastrophe, end of quote. And Edward went on to state the obvious, that the Palestinian people do not bear any blame for the destruction of European Jewry. That's in quotes also. This argument is straightforward enough. It's obvious enough. And it is, of course, it's repeated by Palestinians and all of us over and over and over again. I mean, constantly. But for the most part, the argument is ignored or just pushed aside, especially in the United States and Germany. But, again, we're seeing cracks opening up. And, we are slowly making some progress and cutting through the mystification and the ideology. Certainly here in the United States, we're seeing our BDS movement picking up. It is. But in Germany, the situation is still pretty overwhelming. But even here, even in Germany, there's signs. As for the German government, they're certainly immovable. German leaders remain totally biased toward Israel. Absolutely. Actually, this is pretty much like what we see here in the United States. But the German population, and now we use the term civil society, is a somewhat different story. Cracks are opening up in the German mind over there. So keep an eye on Germany. We've just seen this really great conference happening over there. Yes, in Stuttgart, Germany. I do think we can take this as one more hopeful sign indeed. There's much more to be said about this, but now let's listen to Ali Abanima from Stuttgart.
Good morning, and I want to start by reiterating the thanks which were given by Haidar yesterday and by Ilan to our organizers for bringing us together. It's so important There was a time when people used to flee Germany because of political repression, and this is a time when people come to Germany because political repression gives them no choice but to come here and meet here. So this is something you should be proud of. This is not my first time in Germany. I was here a few times as a child. And in about 1986, I visited with my school, I visited Berlin. At that time, Berlin was a divided city. And I remember we were taken to see the wall and to Checkpoint Charlie, and we went in the underground railway and passed through the stations which were blockaded, and you would see soldiers with machine guns. And we went to East Berlin and passed through the checkpoints with the mirrors above, and all this system which was so oppressive to the people who lived under it, because it was a system devised to keep people apart. I remember until now seeing the wall go down the middle of streets. One side of the street was still there. The houses were still there overlooking the wall. On the other side of the street, there were no more houses. They had been demolished, and there was the so-called no man's land in between. And my overall impression of this system was how permanent it was. And in 1986, it seemed to me and to all who witnessed it that this was a tragedy, a very unfortunate reality, that we would never see an end to it in our lives. Nobody talked about the end of this system at that time. And it was just about 3 years later, in November 1989, that the wall cracked and later collapsed. And so one thing we learned from the history of Germany is to expect the unexpected. And I think that we have to also expect the unexpected in Palestine. That a system of oppression that is so real and so harmful and so devastating to the lives of millions of people seems permanent, but is not. And it can be ended, and I think it will be ended. And we have to start with what our vision is for the end, I think. And this goes back to the theme of the conference, separated in the past. Actually, I would like to make one correction, separated in the present, not in the past, and together in the future. And that should be our vision, that Israelis and Palestinians can live together under conditions of full equality. This is the most important thing. A few years ago, in 2007, Ilan and I met in Madrid, and I know at least one other person in the room was in Madrid who I recognize. We were part of a conference that met to discuss the one-state solution. And one of the products, after a lot of discussion, was a statement called the One-State Declaration, which we issued not to say this is the final answer, but to say this is our idea, and we invite everyone to participate in discussing it and building it and amending it. And I think, though, that it because we put a lot of effort into it, it remains for me a very economical statement of what our vision should be and the principles. And I want to just read a few sections of it, because it's quite long, so I'm not going to read the whole thing. But you can find it online if you just put in Google the One State Declaration. And I believe I've seen it translated now. We have official translations in Arabic and Hebrew and Spanish. But I've also seen translations in French, and there may be one in German. I'm not sure, but on the internet you find everything. And I think our... It's not my phone.
Not my phone.
It's over there.
Okay. The preamble is important because we wanted to state the problem. And so we said, for decades, efforts to bring about a two-state solution in historic Palestine have failed to provide justice and peace for the Palestinian and Israeli Jewish peoples, or to offer a genuine process leading towards them. This is the point Ilan was making, that this so-called peace process has nothing to do with the reality. The two-state solution ignores the physical and political realities on the ground and presumes a false parity in power and moral claims between a colonized and occupied people on the one hand and a colonizing state and military occupier on the other. Now, this is a very important point because one of the distortions that has infected our discussions of Palestine is we talk about an Israeli-Palestinian conflict as if they are equals, as if it's just two groups of people and they can't get together. This is like talking about slavery in the United States as the black-white conflict. I want to be like Haidar and offend sensibilities here. Not offend them, but pay no attention to them, let's say. What about if we talk about German history as the German-Jewish conflict? We cannot do that. We cannot do that. It's a violation of the history and the memory to create an equation. So we have to recognize the power imbalance. So we concluded in our preamble that the two-state solution condemns... that it is built on the unjust premise that peace can be achieved by granting limited national rights to Palestinians living in areas occupied in 1967, that's to say the West Bank and Gaza Strip, or just pieces of the West Bank, because that's all Israel is willing to talk about, while denying the rights of Palestinians inside the 1948 borders, the Palestinian citizens of Israel, and those in the diaspora, the refugees. The two-state solution therefore condemns Palestinian citizens of Israel to permanent second-class status within their homeland in a racist state that denies their rights by enacting laws that privilege Jews constitutionally, legally, politically, socially, and culturally. And of course it denies the refugees their rights. So, what we put forward is a vision. We took inspiration. Now, there was some discussion earlier about comparisons. Comparisons are not only a negative thing, they're also a positive thing. We have to learn from them. We have to learn from examples of how other people have overcome or tried to overcome such conflicts. And I'm using the term conflict because you see how deeply entrenched this language is. But we took inspiration from the Freedom Charter in South Africa, from the Belfast Agreement in Northern Ireland, and from other universal principles, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This is what we built our vision on, not on something strange or unusual, but on the most common and fundamental human principles. So we stated, the historic land of Palestine belongs to all who live in it and to those who were expelled or exiled from it since 1948, regardless of religion, ethnicity, national origin, or current citizenship status. You'll notice that this vision doesn't exclude anybody. It doesn't threaten Israelis in any way. On the contrary, it includes them. But on one condition, and that's contained in the second paragraph. Any system of government must be founded on the principle of equality and civil, political, social, and cultural rights for all citizens. Power must be exercised with rigorous impartiality on behalf of all people in the diversity of their identities. Now, this is not a strange thing. This second paragraph is taken almost verbatim from the Belfast Agreement, which the European Union and every government in Europe praised and spent billions of euros to support the peace process in Northern Ireland based on this principle. So we will not be called extremists or anti-Semites or whatever else they want to call us, because we advocate basic principles of democracy for Palestinians and Israelis. I don't care what they call me for saying that. And the remaining paragraphs deal with what it takes to get there, because you cannot just say, okay, now everybody is equal, when for 63 years you've had a system of oppression and ethnic cleansing and apartheid, an ongoing Nakba that continues to this day. So we talk about that there must be just redress for the devastating effects of decades of Zionist colonization in the pre- and post-state period, including the abrogation of all laws and ending all policies, practices, and systems of military and civil control that oppress and discriminate on the basis of ethnicity, religion, or national origin. Again, nothing unusual there. The most normal thing in the world in 2010. The recognition of the diverse character of the society, encompassing distinct religious, linguistic, and cultural traditions and national experiences. Now, I know recently that the Chancellor declared that multiculturalism has failed in Germany. We still want to give it a try in Palestine, if you don't mind. Somebody wittier than me said, but monoculturalism also failed in Germany, so what will they do now? I hope I'm not offending you too much.
It's only Mrs. Merkel's problem, it's not our problem. She has failed.
She's not great.
And the remaining clauses of the One State Declaration deal with the non-sectarian nature of the state, the right of return, transparent and non-discriminatory immigration policy, the recognition of the historic connections between communities inside the country and outside the country, which includes both Jewish and Arab diasporic communities, and the establishment of legal and institutional frameworks for justice, restitution, and reconciliation. So that was the One State Declaration, and I think it's important to start with a vision and say what we're for, and that's what I stand for, and that's what I believe in. But the other theme of the conference deals with obstacles. So we have to recognize that there are obstacles in front of this vision, which includes the present-day reality of a racist apartheid state currently in Israel. I want to give you a couple of examples from the news as it is today. Ilan, who's written the brilliant history of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, and you can find his book at the back in about 7 languages, right? But I'm saying that because I also want to mention that you find my book too. Only in English, though. But after the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948, within the area which became Israel in 1948, 90% of the Palestinians were expelled, and many of them today and their children and grandchildren living in Gaza with Haidar in a giant prison. And he managed to escape from the prison for a week. And I mean, we say it like it's something funny, but it's not funny, it's the reality. And the crime for which Haidar and 1.5 million other people are imprisoned in Gaza is what? It's something that people usually don't speak. But their crime is that they're not Jewish. That's their crime. Because if you changed one thing about the people of Gaza, the Palestinian people in Gaza, if Israel suddenly recognized them as Jewish, they would open the gates of the ghetto and the people would be invited back to their land. And most of their land is empty. Most of it is empty. There's a great myth that, well, a return is not practical because all of the land is occupied by Israelis now and it would be too difficult. Actually, most of the land is empty. But after the ethnic cleansing in 1948, 90% of the population within what became Israel was expelled and reduced to what? About 150,000 people. In the 63 years since that time, the Palestinian population within Israel has grown to now about 1.4 million, almost 10 times. How many towns, does anybody know, how many new towns and villages has Israel allowed Palestinians within Israel to build in these 63 years for their growing population?
Zero.
Zero. As against about 1,000 Jewish settlements and towns that have been built in that town. So one of the consequences of the growth of population and the restriction on land and building is that Palestinians now within Israel, I'm not talking about the West Bank and Gaza, are moving to where there is housing. And where there is housing is in Jewish towns, because that's the only place they allow construction. So we see a reaction within Israel as Palestinians, citizens of the state, at least supposedly citizens of the state, move to towns which are predominantly Jewish, and of course many of which used to be Palestinian before 1948. So an example that really struck me recently from Haaretz, from the Israeli newspaper from the beginning of this month, from November 3rd, and it says, did you see this story? It's an amazing story. In Safad, in the north. Safad was plastered with posters on Tuesday denouncing a long-time resident for renting an apartment to three Bedouin studying at the local college, three Arab students. The apartment owner, Eli Tzvavieli, had decided to go through with the rental despite threats that his home would be torched. The posters are the latest episode in an ongoing campaign waged by certain Safad residents, led by Chief Municipal Rabbi Shmuel Eliyahu, to halt the influx of Arab students attracted by the college. Because, of course, how many Arabic language universities are there in Israel for the indigenous Palestinian Arabic-speaking population? Zero. Residents who oppose this campaign believe that in light of a recent incident in which three Arab students were brutally attacked, the posters could incite an attack on the 89-year-old Tzvavieli, who is named explicitly on the signs. Tzvavieli, the posters say, is returning the Arabs to Safad. It's a crying shame. Tzvavieli said, I'm scared, he told Haaretz, but I have an obligation toward these lovely students. They're in school every day and needed a place to sleep at night. A very human and normal response. And then just some background. A few months ago, Shmuel Eliyahu, the chief rabbi, the local rabbi, and 17 other rabbis issued a public call to residents not to sell or rent apartments to non-Jews. That was followed by an emergency convention 3 weeks ago at which speakers lashed out against the influx of Arab students. And then about 10 days ago, this is from the beginning of November, three Arab students were physically assaulted, one of whom was shot. Now, This incident is not in any way unique. It's not like I'm picking something that is rare. I have in front of me, I won't read them all, but just so you know I'm telling you the truth, countless examples of this, countless. This is from October 26th from Yediot Ahronot, about the town of Carmiel in Israel. Where is Carmiel?
Between Akka and...
Okay, in the north as well. Where the deputy mayor of the town placed advertisements in the newspaper to say, this is quoting from the advertisement, residents are welcome to turn to us the moment they become aware of an apartment or a flat which is about to be sold to someone from one of the surrounding Arab villages. Once a flat in Carmiel is sold to an Arab family, it is a solid fact for generations to come. And the deputy mayor claims that they prevented the sale of 30 apartments to Arabs through this system. What's different? Now, something like this could happen in Germany. It could happen in the United States. It could happen in any country. But the difference is, in other countries, you have a system, you have a standard that says there must be no discrimination. There are human rights. There is recourse. The government must take action to prevent this. You have rights which you can pursue. That's not the case in Israel. On the contrary, this is encouraged by the state, by the authorities. It's the vision, it's the ideal of a so-called Jewish and democratic state. Now, within Israel, there are a few Israeli Jews who protest against this, and a few dozen held a demonstration a few weeks ago. And one of them, Professor Aliza Shenhar, said the following. Imagine a university in a certain country, let's say Germany, and a priest forbidding the residents from renting out apartments to Jews. I know we're not supposed to make comparisons. It's not me, though. I'm just quoting. I'm just quoting from the Israeli press. This is from Yediot Ahronot, an Israeli newspaper. So if somebody who's watching on the video or wants to accuse me of anti-Semitism, they need to send the accusation to Yediot Ahronot, not to me. And continuing the quote from Aliza Shenhar, here we have a chief rabbi whose salary comes from the taxes paid by you and me, and he's telling people not to rent apartments to Arabs at all costs. We are reaching an unbelievably high level of discrimination and racism we never imagined reaching. I feel great shame. Now, it's important to know that there are Israeli voices like that, but it's important not to have any illusions. They're very few, and we cannot wait for them to make the change alone. They need our support from the outside through boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and that's what we're going to talk about tomorrow. But in my remaining few minutes, I want to talk about some of the other obstacles to the one-state solution. One of them, which I confront all the time, people say, well, you have this very beautiful vision and it sounds so nice. But the problem is Israelis will never accept it. And if you look at the opinion polls, maybe 5 or 10% of Israelis are open to this idea. Although Ilan was telling me yesterday at the recent conference on the one-state solution in Haifa, there were a lot of Jews and Palestinians there. So there is at least some Israelis who are open to this idea. But the point I want to make is that, of course, Israeli Jews are against this idea. And here's where we can learn from another comparison. I kept hearing this objection, saying, well, you know, but Israeli Jews will never accept it. So I was curious. I said, well, what about whites in South Africa? Were they open to the idea of a one person, one vote democracy before it happened? How many supported it? I mean, if they were so much in favor of it, why did it take so long? Why did it take so long? And I actually went back and I published this as an article, and I presented it on my first visit to South Africa earlier this year, which was amazing. I went back to the 1980s and I looked at all the newspaper articles, to the opinion polls which were done among whites in South Africa. And to summarize, what you find until the early 1990s, remember, Nelson Mandela was released in 1990, and the first democratic election was in 1994. Until the early 1990s, the number of white South Africans who said we would accept a system of one person, one vote in a fully democratic South Africa was about, depending on the poll, between 2 and 5%. Most said, well, we know apartheid is wrong, but we have to have some system of group rights where, you know, the whites maintain a veto or some system that guarantees us a disproportionate say in the country. And that didn't happen. In the end, you had a national unity government, a transitional government, and then one person, one vote system. What made the difference? The difference was two things. One was internal resistance and external pressure on the one hand, which raised the price of the status quo for whites. And the other was the acknowledgement, I think, by the ANC and Nelson Mandela that whites had fears. That not all their fears were illegitimate. That the question they asked, well, if we let go of power, what will happen to us? Will we be, you know, will we lose everything? And they were able to address that directly, but without compromising on any principles of democracy and equality. And I think that's a lesson we have to take. The final point, and my time is almost up, is to recognize also that this sort of political transition doesn't lead to utopia. And South Africa is not a utopia. And when I was in South Africa, I saw outside Cape Town. Cape Town is a beautiful city, but if you travel just outside the city to the Cape Flats, you see vast townships, new ones that have appeared since 1994, terrible poverty. And people say, aha, you see, Uri Avnery says things like this. Look, the inequality is worse in post-apartheid South Africa. And this is true. But it's important to recognize that the inequality, the economic inequality, is not the result of ending apartheid. What was the alternative to ending apartheid? The inequality in South Africa and the poverty today is the result of apartheid. It's the continuation and the legacy of apartheid. So the other lesson we have to take is that you have to go much further than a political settlement, that you have to build economic justice and economic equality into any political settlement, and this has to be from the basic foundation. So I believe that this vision is the only realistic possibility, to echo Haider's words from yesterday. I believe that in terms of public opinion within Israel and within the Palestinian community, it is gaining ground and can be the majority idea within a very short time. And I think it is the most moral and pragmatic solution. And I think that, as German history shows us, basically you have to not only expect the unexpected, but be ready for the unexpected. And that's why we have to have this discussion now. Thank you.
Well, you've just been listening to Ali Abu Nima, the talk he gave at a Palestine Solidarity Conference held a few weeks ago in Stuttgart, Germany. And you're listening to the program This Week in Palestine. And we can remind you again, you're tuned to WZBC Newton, Massachusetts, 90.3 FM on your dial. This program's part of Truth and Justice Radio. This talk that you just heard by Ali can actually be viewed online as a video, and the same goes for the other talks at this conference. You can just do a search and put in three words, Stuttgart, which is spelled S-T-U-T-T-G-A-R-T, Palestine, and Abu Nima, that's A-B-U-N-I-M-A-H, or Pape, P-A-P-P-E. And these videos will come up for you, and you can watch them. This conference at the end also prepared a statement, a closing document, which I think it's really excellent. And it's online. You can find it. The title is simply Stuttgart Declaration. Again, you can find it easily online, Stuttgart Declaration. Again, it's spelled S-T-U-T-T-G-A-R-T. So we'll end the program now. This is Ken Barney. We're thanking you once again for listening to This Week in Palestine. And we'll be back next week.